the only one who could understand the pull of the lover being the steady, and yet to tell the steady before she found out, would wreck it all. Inside the house of God, Barry did not seem to exist. And even outside, when I was with Molly, she didn't seem to exist either. And so it had become clear to Chuck and me that one way to survive was sexually. This was terribly puzzling and threatening to our sexual dud of a resident, Joe. For the only time she had dropped much below the top of the class at BMS had been in medical aspects of human sexuality. Her limbic was out to lunch. Our trump card with Joe could always be sex. When the runt showed up, he was so nervous, from having spent 8 weeks with a 00 resident named Mad Dog and with Hyper Hooper and Eat My Dust Eddie, from having heard about the toughies awaiting him on our ward, from living with the fear that he was going to die, from being stuck with a needle from the yellow man's groin, and also from his intellectual poet, June, who was furious at him for spending time away from her. He was so nervous that he seemed to be flying, living 3 inches above the floor. His hair was frazzled, and his mustache seemed to be alive, and he tugged first at one end and then at the other. Chuck and I tried to talk him down, but it was no use, and so we called for Molly to get the syringe of Valium. "Okay, man," said Chuck. "Pull down your pants." "Here? Are you crazy?" "Go ahead," I said. "We've got things all ready for you." The runt pulled down his pants and bent over the nursing station desk. In walked Molly with a friend of hers, a nurse from the MICU, Medical Intensive Care Unit, named Angel. Angel was red-headed, buxom, Irish, with wraparound muscular thighs and a creamy complexion. Working in intensive care, the death row of the house was rumored to have intensified her sexuality. And it was said that year after year, Angel gave intensive care not only to the sick, but also to the male turn. This talent, perhaps apocryphal, had at any rate yet to be experienced by anyone in our group. "Molly," I said, "I'd like you to meet the new turn, the runt." "Pleased to meet you," said Molly. "This is Angel." Craning his neck around, the runt blushed. His bull coccygeals tightened, causing his testes to leap up in his scrotum like startled fish in an electrified pond, and he said, "Pleased to meet you. I've never met anyone in this position before. It's their idea, not mine." "Oh, it's," gesturing up toward the thin air, "nothing new for a," gesturing toward herself. "Nurse," said Angel. How strange that Angel had difficulty putting words together without gesturing. But it must have had something to do with her nervousness at meeting Runt from the rear. Angel seemed to be having a hard time resisting the impulse to go to the Runt and run her creamy hands over his leering, lumpy rump, his cheeks, his testicles, even the crenellations of his anus. Why not? We settled on Angel delivering the dose of Valium, which she did with professional skill, finishing by planting a kiss on the spot. The nurses left, and we asked the runt how he felt, and he said fine, and in love with Angel, but that he was still scared stiff about starting with the toughies on the ward. "Man, there's nothing to worry about," said Chuck. "Even though you inherit Potts' disasters, you inherit Tao, too."
"Who is Tao?"
"Tao?
Tao, boy, you get in here stat," yelled Chuck.
"Tao is the best damn BMS you ever saw." He was. In he walked, 4 feet tall, with thick black glasses and thick black skin, with a voice gruff as a drill sergeant and a vocabulary that was short and tough like him. The words Tao knew, he slurred, and his main gift was action, not talk. He was a locomotive from Georgia.
"Tao," said Chuck, "this is the runt. He's going to be your new turn, starting tomorrow."
"Mm-hmm. High the runt," growled Tao. "Boy," said Chuck, "you got to run the runt service just like you did Potts's, okay? Now you tell him about it."
"Runt. 22 patients, 11 gomers, 5 sickies, and 6 turkeys who never should have been here in the first place. All in all, 9 of them are on the roller coaster.
Roller coaster?
Right, said Tao, making a motion with his hand like a car on a roller coaster. Up and down, and finally up and flying out into space. He means turfed out of the house, I said.
But what about the sickies? Asked the runt. I'd better start seeing them right away?
Nope, you don't have to. That takes care of them. I never let the new turn touch him, not till I'm sure he knows what he's on about.
But you can't write orders, said the runt.
Oh, I can write them. I just can't sign them. Go home, runt, and come on back in tomorrow. Well, gotta go finish my shit on the ward so I can take off early. So long, runt. Tomorrow.
Despite our preparations, Joe and Ward 6 South began to destroy the runt. Joe, on call with him, took up where Mad Dog had left off, making the runt feel that he never could do enough and that he never should do anything without first consulting her. Afraid to risk, the runt didn't learn. Joe's aggressive approach to the Gomers soon created for the runt the sickest, most pitiful service on the ward. The runt was completely disorganized, and worse, if a patient did poorly, he thought it was his fault. If Lazarus bled, it was his fault. If a bird-like woman with intransigent bowels hadn't had a bowel movement, it was his fault. He began spending more time talking to his patients, and formed such an attachment to one old man that whenever the runt showed up, the old fellow would grasp his hand, start to cry, kiss his hand, say that the runt was his only friend. And when the runt would try to leave, the old fellow would kiss his hand again, start to cry, and offer him, over and over, the same present. A used bow tie. Despite Chuck, Towel, and me, the runt was being eaten up by guilt. We'd seen it happen to Potts, and we didn't want it to happen again. Chuck and I decided that if the runt could only get something going with Angel, he might gain some confidence. His poet, fed up with his being too preoccupied with medicine to read her runes, now demanded that he sleep out on the living room couch. Yet the runt was too unsure of himself to ask Angel out.
"Why don't you ask her out?" I'd ask. "Don't you like her?"
"Like her? I'm nuts about her. I dream about her. She's beautiful. She's the kind of woman my mother would never let me go out with. She's what I watched my roommate Norman screw for 4 years at BMS. A centerfold.
So why don't you ask her out?"
"I'm scared she won't like me and say no."
"So what? What have you got to lose?"
"The possibility, if she says no, that she might have said yes. Whatever I do, I don't want to lose that possibility."
"Look, man," said Chuck, "you know unless you get your dick moving a little faster, you're never going to learn medicine at all."
"What the hell does that have to do with it?"
"Who knows, man? Who knows?"
But instead of asking her out, the runt kept floundering in guilt on the ward, and kept tossing and turning fitfully on the couch in the living room of the poet, and kept going to the funerals of his dead young patients, and kept letting Joe lop a bit off his schlong daily by telling him what he'd failed to do. And on top of all that, at his poet's suggestion, she being deep into the anal sadistic stages of her psychoanalysis, the runt followed the path of cure that had warped his organ in the first place in his hyperanalyzed family, and went back to the therapist he'd had throughout BMS to work out the torment he'd felt from his promiscuous roommate, Norman, who had had an electric organ and played only one song, "If You Knew Susie, Like I Know Susie." That song, because all of his girlfriends were named Susie, and each was oh so delighted when she knocked on Norman's door, and he leaped to his organ, yelled, "Come on in, Susie," and in the words of each Susie, "played my song." One horrendously hot and steamy night I was on call, and the runt, working late, refused to leave a patient of his who was in serious trouble. I urged the runt to go home. And then I urged him to call up Angel and ask her out. And he would do neither. Towel had gone home, and so the runt was at a loss about what to do with his patients, a particular problem being Reisenschein,
a lolin gnat whose bone marrow had been wiped out by our cytotoxic agents and had failed to regenerate blood cells, which meant that she was bound to die. The runt kept asking me what to do with her. Since I was busy with my admissions and with keeping track of the decompensating ward of toughies, I blew my cool and said, "Get out of here, damn it! I'll take care of things. Go home." "I don't want to go home. June's at home. If I go back there, we'll get into some argument about her anal sadism." "So long," I said, walking off. "Where are you going?" "To the bathroom," I said. "I've got the flu." I retreated to the sanctuary of the toilet, wrapped in the latest graffiti. Was St. Francis ass easy? "What should I do?" wailed the runt outside the door. "Call up Angel." "I'm afraid. Why should I call her anyway?" Receiving no answer, he struggled with the silence and said, "All right." "Damn, I almost forgot. I'm late for therapy. I'll call her when I get back." "Nope. Call her now, and don't come back. I'm on call here, see?" So he finally called her and asked her out, and rushed off to talk it all over with the therapist, whom he was paying $50 an hour to take the starch out of his penis. I sat at the nursing station, worn out by a nagging influenza that had me shitting on the hour, and overcome with gloom at the work I had to do. The sun was setting over the changing leaves, and even though it was a boiling hot Indian summer night, I knew that soon the days would turn crisp and clear and bright football weather when you huddled with a sweatered woman under a blanket and got drunk to avoid getting cold and kissed her lips and shivered. "Mrs. Biles is back from her cardiac catheterization," said my BMS, Bruce Levy the Lost. The cath fellows wrote in the chart that Mrs. Biles had excessive bleeding from the site of needle puncture in the groin. "I'd better work it up, Dr. Bash. She might have a bleeding disorder." Mrs. Biles had no bleeding disorder. The cath boys always wrote excessive bleeding to buff the charts in case of litigation. In fact, Mrs. Biles, Little Otto's patient, didn't even have cardiac disease at all. But as everyone, including Otto, knew, bursitis. Little Otto was after the big bucks. Bruce Levy, the BMS, was after playing the invent an obscure disease to make an A in medicine game. Who was I to stand in his way? "Sounds interesting, Bruce. How are you going to work it up?" Bruce rattled off several blood tests he was about to order. "Wait a sec," said Joe, who'd been on her way out, but who had stopped back in to make sure all was okay, before she went back out to where she was just another lonely single woman, and not an admiral of the Gomers in the House of God. "Those tests cost a fortune. What evidence do you have that she has a bleeding disorder? For example, did you ask her if she suffers from nosebleeds?" "Hey, great idea," said Bruce, and ripped off down the hall to ask. Returning, he said, "Yeah, she suffers from nosebleeds." "Great." "Wait a sec," I said. "Everybody will say that when you ask, right?" "Yeah, right," said Brucey, looking crestfallen. "Did you ask her if she bleeds after tooth extraction?" said Joe. "Hey, terrific idea," said Bruce, and ran out again. "Yep, she bleeds like crazy after tooth extractions." "Brucey, everyone bleeds like crazy after extractions," I said. "Damn it, Dr. Bash, you're right," said the BMS. And he looked sad, since to become an intern in the BMS system, he had to make an A. And to do that, he had to make a disease so he could make a cure and make a lecture. And he saw his grade fluttering down toward low C, and his internship moving west of the Hudson River. "Say, Brucey," I said nonchalantly, "what about bruising?" "Bruising? Hey, fantastic idea." "Wait, save yourself a trip. She's going to say yes, that she bruises easily, right?" "Right, Dr. Bash, who wouldn't say that?" "No one," I said. "But how can you test it out for sure?" "I don't know," said Brucey, his fist furrowing his brow. "Too bad," I said. "Bleeding disorders are fascinating." All of a sudden, Brucey lit up, shouted, "I got it," and ran down the hallway. And a few seconds later, there echoed back up to us a scream, "Yow!" And in a moment, Brucey was back, grinning from ear to ear, and he said, "Well, I did it," and reached for the hematology slips.
You did it.
You did what? Asked Joe, eyes popping.
I bruised her.
What? You did what?
Just like you suggested, Joe. I bruised Mrs. Biles, punched her in the arm.
You were right.
I shouldn't have gone ahead with this expensive workout until I'd bruised her with my own two hands.
Just before the runt returned from his therapy, a 42-year-old patient of his had a cardiac arrest. And as the runt came down the hallway, he was passed by the intubated patient being wheeled to the MICU by Eat My Dust Eddie, the turn on rotation here. The runt looked horrified and said, I'm sure it was something I did wrong.
Don't be silly, I said. It's a good turf. Now get out of here. You'll be late for your date with Thunder Thighs.
I'm not going.
You are.
Think of those red pubic hairs.
I can't. I better go see Miss Reisenschein. I feel terrible that these young patients are all dying.
Law number 4, the patient is the one with the disease. Get the hell out of here, I said, pushing him out the door.
Scram.
I'll call you from the Chinese restaurant.
Call me from the saddle or don't call me at all.
But why? Why? He screamed, his foot jamming the door like a salesman. Why am I doing this?
Because it's limp.
Because what's limp?
The whole goddamn shooting gallery. So long.
He left. As usual, all hell broke loose on the ward, mostly with Runt's patients. The runt had learned to be aggressive with the Gomers and cautious with the dying young. And since Chuck and I had begun to believe the fat man's idea that the reverse was the essence of medical care, the runt's patients were disasters. And the first part of each night on call had to be spent buffing the runt's service, in secret, hidden from Joe, the runt, and the charts. Surreptitiously, I'd slip into the room containing the young asthmatic who would die without the steroids that the runt was afraid to give her, and bam, bam, hit her with a big secret dose that would get her through the night. Next, it would be his nice leukemic lady, whom Tao was keeping alive. And secretly, I'd transfuse her 6 more units of platelets without which she'd bleed out before sunrise. And the final horrendoma was Lazarus, the alcoholic janitor, who was always in shock, always infected, and whom the runt was always treating with homeopathic doses of meds for fear of doing something bad. Each day, Lazarus made a determined effort to die, usually by bleeding out from nose or lip or gut or balls, and each night, Chuck or I, in a clandestine and almost religious operation, would buff the shit out of him for his next day's thrilling adventures with a turn who was limp and unstrung and scared to death of doing anything active. Anything active at all. That night I remembered that I'd forgotten what the runt had told me just before he'd left the first time, when I'd asked him if he'd tapped the infection in Lazarus's acidic belly.
He's all right, the runt had said, looking away.
Wait a sec, I'd said.
Did you tap his belly or not?
Nope.
Jesus Christ, why the hell not?
I never learned how. You need to use a big needle, and
I was scared I'd hurt him.
Limp. Cursing, I went into Lazarus's room, where he was dying again in earnest, and since I'd been in this situation with him every other night on call, I knew what to do, and got busy raising him up yet again. Molly came up and said I had a phone call.
It was the runt.
How's Mrs. Reisenschein? He asked.
Fine. But Lazarus just started to go down the tubes, I said, telling myself I won't yell at him for not having tapped his belly.
I should have tapped his belly.
Where are you?
Chinatown. But how's Lazarus?
What did you have?
Lo mein, mugu gai pan, and a lot of rice, but how is he?
Sounds delicious. He went down the tubes, I said.
Oh, no, I'm coming in.
But I saved him.
Hey, great.
Hang on, I said, watching Molly gesture from Lazarus's room. He's trying to go down the tubes again.
I'm coming in.
What are you doing after dinner?
I thought I'd take her back to my place.
What, with June there? Are you nuts?
Why not?
Never mind. I gotta go. But listen, whatever you do, do not take her back to your place. Go to her place. Remember, fake high, go low.
So long.
For some reason, admission diagnoses in the House of God ran in spurts. 3 cardiac, 2 renal, 4 pulmonary. That hot and dismal night, the disease matched the oppression. It was cancer night at the house. First, it was a little tailor named Saul. As I read his chart in the EW, Howard, the turn who seemed to love every aspect of the turnship, and whom I hated for that, bubbling with excitement at really being a doc, told me that Saul had pneumonia. The blood smear told me that Saul had acute leukemia, his pneumonia being part of his generalized sepsis because his white cells didn't work. Saul knew he was sick, although he didn't know yet how sick. And when I wheeled him to X-ray for the chest film, I asked him if he could stand up by himself.
"Stand up. I could beat you full game," said Saul,
and fell down. I propped him up, this little, bony, just young enough to die old man, whom I'd just told he had leukemia. As I left him to himself in front of the X-ray beam, his boxer shorts fell down. "Saul," I said, "you're losing your shorts."
"Yeah, so? Here I'm losing my life, and you tell me I'm losing my shorts?"
I was moved. He was all of our grandfathers. With the laconic resignation of a diasporic Jew, he was watching the latest Nazi, leukemia, force him from his only real home, his life. Leukemia was the epitome of my helplessness. For the treatment was to bomb the bone marrow with cell poisons called cytotoxins until it looked, under the microscope, like Hiroshima, all black, empty, and scorched. And then you waited to see whether the marrow regenerated any healthy cells, or the same old cancer. And since there was a period of time when there were no blood cells, no whites to fight infection, and no reds to carry oxygen, and no platelets to stop bleeding, to deliver care was to fight the infection and transfuse red cells for oxygen and platelets to control bleeding all the time, creating more bleeding and anemia by drawing blood for countless tests. Terrific. I'd gone through it with Dr. Sanders, and I hated it. The start of this horrific treatment was to inject modified rat poison, nicknamed the Red Death for its color, and the way it eroded your skin if you splashed it around, directly into Saul's veins. Thinking, "So long, marrow," I did so, brimming with disgust. The second EW admission, Jimmy the name, cancer the game, young enough to die for sure. Howard, smiling, chubby, smoking his chubby pipe like a TV doc, presented the case to me. Pneumonia. And Howard thought he might have leukemia. One look at Jimmy's chest X-ray showed that Howie had missed a humongous lung cancer that would kill Jimmy pretty quick. As I worked on him in the EW, trying to shoo away the hovering Howie, I heard Hooper battling a Gomer behind the next curtain. The Gomer, his third admission of the night, was trying to kick him in the nuts. I asked Hooper how it was going.
"Terrible. M.O.R., Roy. M.O.R.
M.O.R.
Marriage on rocks. We're both doing everything we can, joined a California-style sauna where they whip you with hot eucalyptus leaves and give you some aqua-nude group psychotherapy. But I don't think it's going to work. The little woman is mad as hell that I'm here all the time and that I'm into death."
"You're into death? Who isn't? It's where we're all headed, you know." "I can't deny that, but I guess I don't get the charge out of it that you do." "I'm sorry about the M.O.R., I said, wondering if my R, for relationship, would get to the point of R.O.R. during the internship. "Doesn't matter," said the hyperactive turn. "No kids. In California, being married 2 years means you've hit the median." "Hey, I've got a question for you. Do you think it's legal to have this woman sign her own post-mortem permission slip along with her insurance voucher?"
"It's probably legal, but I'm not sure it's ethical."
"Great," said Hooper. "Another post coming up. In Sausalito, nobody's heard of ethics. Hey, thanks. I didn't want to stay married to that bitch anyway. You should see what I've got simmering down in the morgue."
"In the morgue?"
"A female pathology student from Israel. Dynamite. Grooves on Thanatos, like me. Romeo and Juliet, man. So long." I sat in the EW nursing station, thinking about how the Lego and the fish had blessed our ward with the toughies, the dying young, like Jimmy, like my friend Dr. Sanders, out there on his last fishing trip before his last autumn. That's tough to do, face the dying and the dead. I looked up. It was one of the policemen, the fat one, Gilheeny.
Strength of character, said the other one, quick. It doesn't grow on trees.
Nor can one buy it in any store, said the redhead. It's the toilet training that does it, I believe. So said Freud and Cohen. Where did an Irish cop learn about Freud, I asked.
Where?
Why, here, man, here. From spending the last 20 years here, 5 nights a week, in trialogues of discussion with fine young, over-educated men like you. Better than night school, more broad and useful, and we get paid to attend.
Not only that, said Quick, but all the different viewpoints contribute. Over 20 years one learns a good deal. Currently a surgeon named Gath brings us the news from the southern rim, and with Cohen we are in the middle of a goldmine of psychoanalytical thought.
Who's Cohen?
A sophisticated, jocular, and unrestrained resident in psychiatry, said Quick. A textbook in himself.
You must make his acquaintance, said Gilheeny, twitching his red eyebrows so that they coerced the rest of his fat face into a gap-toothed smile, he went on, "We can hardly wait to hear from a Rhodes scholar like yourself, a man with high qualities of body and mind, with experience gleaned from corners of the round globe like England, France, and the Emerald Isle, which I have visited only twice."
"A textbook in yourself," said Quick.
Upstairs, I had just finished working Jimmy over, putting in lines and tubes and starting to treat his untreatable diseases, when Mrs. Reisenschein arrested, and I was surprised to hear myself cursing under my breath as I resuscitated her, "I wish she would die so I could just go to sleep." And I was shocked when I realized that I'd just wished a human being dead so I could go to sleep. Animal. Eat My Dust rolled up from the MICU to take Reisenschein away, and I asked how he was.
"Glad you asked. It's going just great. Here, Bob," he said, nodding to his BMS. "Wheel this stretcher on down to the unit, will you, pal? Keep pumping the oxygen and keep the lines open. I'm just going up to floor 8 for a minute to jump off and kill myself."
He left, and Molly, clean and pretty and sexy and off-duty, left. And I was desolate watching her go. I should have been going with her. The runt called back again.
"How's Lazarus?"
he asked. "Stable. Where are you?"
"At Angels. I'm scared. How's Reisenschein?"
"There's nothing to be scared about. Reisenschein's had a cardiac arrest and is in the MICU.
"Oh, no. I'm coming in right away."
"You do, and I'll kill you. Put Angel on."
"Fry, Roy," said a healthy, drunk voice. "I'm..."
Gesture. "Drunk." "Fine. Listen, Angel, I'm worried about the runt. He's not going to make it unless he gets some confidence in himself. He's a great guy, but he needs some confidence. Chuck and I are really concerned. Suicide. That's how concerned we are."
"Suicide?"
Gesture.
"Wow! What can I do?"
I told Angel exactly what she could do to prevent the runt's suicide.
"Suicide?"
Gesture.
"You mean he's free?"
"Not yet, Angie. Right now he's still a bird in a cage. Open it up, Angel. Set him free. Let him fly."
"Fly, fly his..."
Gesture. "Fly, bye, bye." And the phone went dead. Hot, sweaty, with the dried sweat salt like sand on my eyelids, with my flu declaring itself in malaise, photophobia, myalgia, nausea, and diarrhea, cursing being in the house while Molly was out and Barry was out, where and with whom, and while the runt was getting seduced out of suicide, I tried to finish my write-up of young and soon-to-be-dead Jimmy. Chubby, grinning, puffing his pipe, Howard appeared. What the hell are you doing up here?
Oh, I thought I'd do some follow-up on Jimmy.
Great case. Guess he's had it, huh?
Oh, and I wanted to ask you about that nurse in the MICU, Angel.
Very fine girl. I thought I might ask her out.
I watched him puff his pipe, and hating him because his happy life, even in the house, was a puff on his pipe, I said,
Oh, so you haven't heard about the runt and Angel?
No, you don't mean...
Exactly. At this very moment.
And Howard, listen carefully. You should see what she does with her mouth.
With her... Her what?
Her mouth, I said, knowing that by morning Howard would have puffed what Angel did with her mouth all over God's house.
See, she takes her lips, and she puts them around his...
Well, I don't want to hear about that, and I'm glad you warned me before I asked her out. But I want to know why when I took Jimmy's blood pressure just now it was only 40 systolic.
It's what? I said, rushing into Jimmy's room, where I found that it was 40 systolic, and Jimmy was trying to die right away. I panicked. I didn't know where to start, to save him. I looked at Howard, leaning casually against the doorway, lighting his pipe and smiling, and I said, Howard, help me with this.
Oh, yes? And what might I do?
I didn't know what he might do or what I might do, either. But then I thought of the fat man, and I said, Page the fat man, stat.
Oh? Do you think you need him?
No, you can handle it, Roy. Besides, they say you can't become a real doctor without killing a few patients, at the least.
Do something to help me, I said, trying to think clearly.
What might I do?
The fat man arrived, puffing from the race up the stairs, and sensing my panic, ordered me to take my own pulse. As I did so, he began to get Jimmy organized so he would not die right then. Fats attacked Jimmy with that fantastic, smooth expertise of his, and you could almost hear the click, click, click of each essential procedure. Fats chattered as he worked, addressing comments to us all, including the nurse and a woman named Gracie from Dietary and Food Services who somehow at that late hour had been with him.
In bed?
What's wrong with Jimmy? Asked Fats, putting in a big needle.
Cancer of the lung, I said.
Christ, said Fats. And he's young enough to die.
If I were you, I'd try Laetril, said Gracie from Dietary and Food Services.
Try what?
Asked Fats, stopping, trying to save Jimmy.
Laetril, a cure for cancer, said Gracie.
A cure for what?
Shot out Fats, standing up, stock still.
The Mexicans have found an extract from apricot pits called Laetril, can cure cancer. Controversial, but...
But worth a big fortuna, said Fats, eyes aglitter.
Hey, listen, I gotta hear more about this, Roy, he said, starting to leave.
Fats, wait, I said. Don't leave me yet.
Did you hear what Gracie said, Roy? A cure for cancer. Come on, Gracie, I want you to tell me more.
It's bullshit, I said. There's no cure for cancer. It's a hoax.
It's not, said Gracie from Dietary and Food indignantly. It worked on my cousin's husband. He was dying, and now he's fine.
Dying, and now he's fine, said Fats. And then, walking toward the door, he murmured, as if in a trance, Dying, and now he's fine.
Please, Fats, I said, don't leave me alone yet, as Jimmy began once again to die, and I began once again to panic.
Why not? Asked Fats, puzzled.
I'm scared.
Still? You still need some help.
Yes, I do.
Well, then you're going to get it. Let's get to work.
We got to work. But soon I realized that Fats had slipped away, and I was left alone with Jimmy and Howie and Maxine, the night nurse. And then I knew that Fats's slipping away and leaving me in charge meant that he knew I could handle it. And I felt a warm rush go through me. I could handle it. And although all I wanted to do was to beat the shit out of Howard, I worked on Jimmy until it was clear that he needed to be breathed by a respirator, which meant a turf to the SICU,
surgical intensive care unit. And as I watched the cheery, sadistic surgical resident wheel Jimmy off, Jimmy, who by now was surrounded by so much tubing that he looked like a meatball in the middle of a plate of spaghetti, I felt great relief. And I heard Howard say, "Impressive job on a tough case." And he left. And I was filled to my eyeballs with hate. With the sweat dripping from my brow onto Jimmy's chart, and the flu dripping through every muscle and bowel villus of my body, I finished my write-up and sent the bruiser along with it to the SICU. I sat for a moment musing. Well, this has been the worst night of my life. But now it's over, and now I can go to sleep. They can't get me now. Through the open window came that comforting smell of fresh rain on hot asphalt. The nurse came in and said, "Mr. Lazarus has just had a bowel movement that is all blood." "Hey, that's really funny, Maxine. You got a great sense of humor." "No, I'm serious. The bed is solid blood." They wanted me to go on, and I could not. The world became the world just before the head-on crash. It could not be what it was. "I can't do anything more tonight," I heard myself say. "I'll see you in the morning." "Look, Roy, don't you understand? He's just bled out a gallon of blood. He's lying in it. You're the doctor, and you have to do something for him." Filled with hate, trying to get rid of thoughts that Lazarus wanted to die, and I wanted him to die, and I had to break my ass to stop him from dying, I went into his room and was face to face with black, putrid, sticky, wet blood. On autopilot, I went to work. My last clear memory was putting a nasogastric tube down into Lazarus's stomach and having the bloody vomit spew up and out and all over me as Lazarus rolled his death-defying eyes. Just after Lazarus, just before dawn, Dr. Sanders came back in, bald from the chemotherapy, infected and bleeding, having had to cut short his fishing trip. "I'm glad you'll be taking care of me again," he said weakly. "So am I," I said, wondering if this admission would be his last, and realizing how attached to him I felt. "Just remember, no whispering behind my back, Roy. And as for heroic measures, we'll talk about that together." I put him in the same room with Saul the leukemic tailor, thinking that while Sanders would die, Saul might be just old enough to survive. How crazy was that? As I lay down in my spewed clothes for my hour's sleep, I found myself wondering where Molly was, more than where Barry was, and wondered if that meant it was the beginning of the ROR, Romance on Rocks. And then I thought with pleasure of the phone call I'd gotten at about 1 a.m. from June, the runt's poet, wondering if I knew where he was. And I chuckled at that, and composed a letter in my head to give the runt in the morning. "Congratulations on your bravo three-dimensional night of love. You are herewith charged with rape. Red pubic hairs, I might warn you, will stand up in court." But then I realized that, God damn, the runt was seeing what Angel did with her mouth while I still hadn't gotten past Molly's long nipples, and then I finally recalled that no one yet knew what Angel did with her mouth, because I'd just made that up to torment that optimist Howard, who knew that being a doc really was the cat's balls after all. And I realized that they could never hurt me more than they had just hurt me that night, and that out of chaos like this had come confidence and skill. Something had happened when I was with Saul and Jimmy and Lazarus and Dr. Sanders. And I didn't know for sure what, but I knew that from taking the risks and learning and remembering fats, I had pinned down my terror and exploded it to bits. From that night on, I might be everything else, but I'd never again be panicked in the house of God. It was a thrilling thought. Almost like in the intern novels, and in the inside of Howard's skull, and in my father's letters. Until I realized with alarm that I hadn't learned how to save anyone at all. Not Dr. Sanders, or Lazarus, or Jimmy, or Saul, or Anna O. And that what I was thrilled about was learning how to save myself.
Chapter 8. By mid-September, according to Joe's schedule, neither I nor any other turn was supposed to have learned how to save himself. That next morning, as the warmth of the fading summer percolated up through the crisp air, as the clear, cirrus football weather blew into the ward through the skeleton of the wing of Zoc rising higher and higher like jail bars over our windows, I showed up for rounds a half hour late. And I was the first turn there. Joe was furious, and when an hour late, Chuck ambled in, wearing yet again the same dirty whites with the same fly open and the same no necktie, Joe exploded, saying, "I told you, Chuck, that round start at 6:30. Got it?" "Fine, fine. Where have you been?" "Oh, well, I've been getting my car fixed." Just as rounds ended, in flew the runt. His hair was frazzled, his belt undone, his shirt was hanging out, his stethoscope dragged from his back pocket, and he had a big smile plastered over his carnival of a face. He was sizzling. "Are you sick?" asked Joe. "Hell no, I feel great." "Where have you been?" "I've been fucking my eyes out," said the runt, and then, roaring, clapped a hand on each of Chuck's and my shoulders and with an idiotic roller coaster of a grin, yelped. "You've been what?" asked Joe. "Fucking. Copulating. You know, vasodilation of the penile veins. It gets hard, and the male sticks it into..." "That's inappropriate." "Hey, Joe," said the runt, looking to us for support and then ignoring her fragility. "Go fuck yourself, huh?" With that, Chuck and I knew we had created a monster, and felt real good about it. But Chuck pointed out that it was sort of like watching your mother-in-law drive your new Cadillac off a cliff. Because we knew that Joe would not go fuck herself, but would go talk to the fish, who would go talk to the Lego, who would get us back but good, since the essence of any hierarchy is retaliation. Joe led the rest of the rounds in silence, until we got to the admission named Jimmy, who'd been turfed to the SICU. Joe insisted we go see him, and as our caravan turned up the hall, Joe got excited about the case, and unable to contain herself any longer, blurted out, "Hey, Roy, that sounds like a really great admission." Without thinking, remembering how Jimmy's decompensation had strung me out, as if from somewhere else than me, although I knew it did come from some bilious region within me, I heard myself create a new law. Number 9. The only good admission is a dead admission. Which stopped Joe in her tracks. The same way that a few minutes later, when Chuck and the runt and I were poodling around the SICU while Joe macerated Jimmy, we were stopped in our tracks when we saw, rigged up in an orthopedic apparatus, the remains of a human. Bandaged from head to toe, it was clear that the patient had collided with something and that the point of impact had been his testicles. They were cantaloupe, even honeydew. Here we had an aberrant Hell's Angel who, on his Harley hog, had smashed head-on into a tree. A sign on the end of his bed read, "It takes balls to ride a Harley." None of us could have imagined what an ace auto mechanic angel was until we heard from the runt how, even the first time, she had fixed his compact car. Well, I was so upset at what was happening last night, I couldn't even talk straight by the time I got to her apartment. I don't know what you said to her on the phone, Roy, but when she hung up, things were a lot easier. She poured me a drink, but all I could think of was Lazarus and Rise and Shine and the graffiti above the urinal at the Chinese restaurant. "Stand closer. It's shorter than you think." Well, anyway, she asked if I'd like to watch TV, and I said sure. We were sitting on the couch, and I didn't know if she liked me, and then all of a sudden she's sort of leaning her boob against me, and her red hair is unpinned and down to her scapula, and I start to feel better. And she says it's kind of uncomfortable in here. Why don't we watch inside? And unplugs the TV and carries it into the bedroom. I couldn't believe it. I start to nuzzle her neck, and she says, "Clothes are such a hassle," and she takes off her sweater and her skirt. Well,
She starts to make husky noises, and since she's taken off her sweater, I take off her bra.
Ah, perfect. Big, soft tits. Ha! Ah.
I pull off her panties, said the runt, pulling off Angel's panties right before our eyes in the middle of the nursing station. And she pulls off my pants. Incredible. What about her pubic hair? I asked.
Bright red, said the runt, with a wild look in his eyes. Perfect. Ha! Ah.
Well, then I kind of hesitated when I go to put it in. And I think of Lazarus dying and all, and, well, it dies too.
Damn, said Chuck.
But she's right there with her hand, and it raises right back up, and when I get it in, she's wet and ready. Not like June or all the others my mother always liked. The first time I was a little off, and I came too soon, but before I knew it, she had her hand between my legs, and we're at it again.
Ha! Ha ha! 23 minutes! I timed it.
And then when she was reaching orgasm, she said something like, "This is terrific," and her words were like a whip spurring me on. Bells rang and the earth shook. Yippee! And then the next time, Chuck and I looked at each other. She was sort of lying there with her back to me, and I thought she was asleep. But no, she kind of reached around and started pulling on my penis, and the next thing I know, she had kind of maneuvered it in, and we were at it again. And I think that was the time that did it.
Yow!
Did what?
Did what you guys said it would. Made me a doc.
We went on and on, her moaning and calling out things, and me sweating and grunting, and just before we came, she started saying, at first in a whisper, and then louder, and then screaming it out, so I was worried that someone might hear, "Dr. Runsky, Dr. Runsky, Dr. Runsky!" And when it was over, lying there, she snuggled up to me and sighed this wonderful, satisfied sigh and said, "Runt, you are a great doc. Good night." And the last thing I saw this morning was the sunlight on those fiery red pubic hairs.
Ha! I owe it all to you. There's nothing I won't try now. Nothing.
Damn, said Chuck. Runt, you've become completely unnervous.
Right. I can't wait to tell that dry bitch June it's over.
Poetry?
Ha! That ain't poetry. This is. You know what's coming next? Neither Chuck nor I knew what was coming next. I'm going to taste her pubic hair, because I know in my heart that it's strawberry red. Roy, I just want to say thanks. Thanks for taking over my service last night, for helping me out, and for kicking me out of the house and into bed with Angel.
Such was the first installment of the runt's relating to us, blow by blow, his love affair with Angel. While Chuck and I at first felt a little uncomfortable listening to the intimate details the morning after each thrilling episode, we didn't feel so bad that we couldn't listen, and we realized that the runt was going through a healthy stage of development that we'd both passed about 10 years before. Besides that, it was unctuous, steamy stuff. In gratitude, we taught the runt medicine, and each of us, with a growing sense of camaraderie, helped each other do the work of the house of God. Shortly after the runt's first auto repair, Chuck's true greatness came out. First, it was Lazarus. Chuck and I, in an effort to lighten the runt's load, had flipped a coin for Lazarus, and he'd become Chuck's patient. One day on rounds, we stopped outside the room Lazarus had occupied since July. Screams came from it. A fresh Gomer was in the Lazarus memorial bed. "What happened to Mr. Lazarus?" asked Joe.
"Oh, he's dead," said Chuck.
"Dead? What happened?"
"Don't know, girl. Don't know. Guess he died."
"Potts and I and the runt and I kept him alive for the past 3 months, and then the first night he was on your service, he died? What's going on?"
"Wish I knew."
"Did you get the post-mortem?"
"Nope."
"Why not?"
"Who knows, girl? Who knows?"
That same day, at Chuck's insistence, we stopped outside the room containing the woman who was to make Chuck famous throughout the house.
"Now this is the most amazing thing," said Chuck. "I was called down to the EW to see this whale. She'd been seen already by Howard, by Mad Dog, and by Putzel. She was lying there, not breathing, worth shit, and no one could figure out why not. Well, I went in there and did my exam. I say to myself, not breathing, huh? Better have a look in her mouth. I opened it up and looked in. Damn, I say, what's that big old green thing in there? So I put on about 4 pairs of gloves, and I reach on back in there, and this is what I found.
He took out a specimen jar in which was a large sprout of broccoli.
Broccoli, said the bruiser with one of his rare correct answers. Nothing but, said Chuck. Howard, Mad Dog, Putzel, none of them dudes bothered to look in the old lady's mouth.
The broccoli lady, I say. A save.
No fooling. Y'all come in and see her.
The broccoli lady was huge, gomer toes, and smelly. Except for an occasional spasmodic shiver of her chest, she still wasn't breathing, and she didn't look like she was doing too great.
Doing great, ain't she? Asked Chuck.
A real save, said the runt. What are you doing for her? Asked Joe.
What am I doing for her? Why, I got her on a low broccoli diet, girl. What else?
From that time on, the house looked at Chuck not as a dumb black admitted on quota, but as a smart turn. As he and I, and even the runt, became competent, we began to realize that since no one else would want to do what we turns were forced to do, we were becoming indispensable. The house needed us. The house thought it needed us to do something for the Gomers and the dying young. What the house really needed us for was to do nothing for the Gomers and to bear the helplessness of caring for the dying young. As autumn flared, as it looked more and more like both Agnew and Nixon would get thrown into the slammer at the same time, we struggled to hide our doing nothing from our ferret, Joe. Rounds became a bravura performance in duplicity, with us trying to recall what imaginary test we'd written down, what imaginary complications had ensued, what imaginary treatment for the imaginary complications had been initiated, and what the imaginary response to all this had been, and all the time working like hell on trying to get the Gomer placed. It was such a great strain on us that occasionally things would break down. One day, faltering under Joe's demanding why I hadn't ordered a 4 a.m. temperature to work up Anna O's imaginary fever, I blurted out another new law. Number 10. If you don't take a temperature, you can't find a fever. And I'd begun to catalog the other things that you might not do to not produce something you might not treat, such as, instead of temperature and fever, substituting EKG and cardiac arrhythmia. And I'd gotten as far as chest X-ray and pneumonia before Chuck and the runt collared me and ushered me out of Joe's grasp. To ease the strain, Chuck and I spent more and more time with our feet up drinking ginger ale in the nursing station, doing nothing. Although the runt was somewhat calmer, he was still too tense to sit with us. Towel, his BMS, was not, and filling a ginger ale container, Towel groaned and put his feet up. Towel, I want to ask you about Enid, said the runt. She's still not cleaned out for a bowel run.
Mm-hmm. Ah, no. So what?
So what should I do? I gotta get her cleaned out. No matter what I do, without eating anything, she keeps gaining weight and hasn't had a bowel movement for the past 3 weeks. Her daughter says she hasn't unloaded spontaneously for 8 years. It's amazing. She turns water into shit.
Mm-hmm. I know. Why you want to do the bowel run?
Because that's why she's here.
Yeah, but I mean, is she really having the bowel run, or are we just pretending she's having the bowel run? Ever since I turned her over to you, I can't keep her straight.
Sheepishly, the runt admitted that Enid's private, Putzel, wanted the bowel run done, and the runt was really trying to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, give her milk and lasses down her mouth and up her direction hole, the both at once.
Milk and lasses?
Right. Milk and molasses. Both ends. She gonna explode.
Inevitably, during our ginger ale rounds, like a floorwalker, the fish would appear. He walked up and, avoiding our eyes, asked, "Hey guys, how's it going?" And then, without waiting to hear how it was going, said, "You know, don't you, that that looks unprofessional."
"Fine, fine," said Chuck, lifting his feet down off the counter.
To irritate the fish, I lit a cigarette.
I hear from Joe that you've been coming in late.
Oh, yeah, said Chuck. Well, the thing is, my car keeps breaking down, and I gotta keep taking it to the garage.
Oh, well, that's different. Got a good mechanic? You could use mine if you like. Get the damn thing fixed right once and for all, so you don't have to worry about it.
Yes.
And another thing, your spelling is atrocious. We'll go over a few of your write-ups together, okay?
Fine, fine.
But there's one thing I don't understand, I said. I can't figure out if I drink 'cause I pee, or I pee 'cause I drink. Stop drinking and see what happens. I tried that. I get thirsty. Perhaps you have Addison's disease, said the fish. And his attention shifted to my cigarette until he couldn't stand it any longer and said, I don't understand how, knowing what you know about lung cancer, you continue to smoke. Maybe you don't inhale? I did not inhale. And so I said, I inhale.
Why do you do it?
It feels good. If everyone did what feels good, where would we all be?
Feeling good.
You're too loose, said the fish. I don't know how you do such good work, being that loose. Enjoy that cigarette, Dr. Bash, for it's 3 more minutes off your life. Just then, little Otto marched in, went to the blackboard to leave a note for me, saw the space taken up with a fresh, ripe MVI, let out a sharp bark which turned all our heads toward him, and finding no eraser handy, spat on the board and wiped the thing off with his sleeve, snarling. Now that's just the kind of thing I resent, I said to the fish, having that damn MVI smeared all over the house under my name. Your kinky bouncers haven't done anything. Can't you stop it?
I tried, said the fish, but it didn't do any good. The damn thing may all be a practical joke anyway.
That's not what I heard. I heard that the prize for MVI is a free trip for two to Atlantic City for the AMA meetings in June with you and the Lego.
I didn't hear that, said the fish, beginning to leave.
Damn, said Chuck. Man, would you look at that?
The fish and I and Towel and Little Otto looked at that, which was, somehow, under my name on the blackboard, in all the colors of the rainbow, that neat yet ornate insignia, Roy G. Bash, MVI. Later that week, the Lego and the Fish called a BM Deli luncheon to announce another award, which we were to nickname the Black Crow. Since this was the first time all the turns had been gathered together since July the 1st, we greeted each other warmly and with relief. Everything had happened. Most of us had learned enough medicine to worry less about saving patients and more about saving ourselves. Although some of our ways of saving ourselves were beginning to seem bizarre, they weren't so far out yet as to be dangerous or intolerable. Looking around the room, hearing the simmering jokes and laughter and chatter that from time to time popped its lid and boiled over into a happy roar, I realized how much we'd grown to care about each other. We were developing a code of caring, helping each other leave early, not fucking each other over, tolerating each other's nuttiness and listening to each other's groans. Each life was being twisted, branded. We were sharing something big and murderous and grand. Sensing that, I felt close to tears. We were becoming doctors. Eat my dust, Eddie. Being run ragged in the death house, the MICU looked awful, and was talking about his previous night on call. I was admitting my 6th cardiac arrest, and I got this call from the EW. Hooper, it was you, saying that there was a guy down there who'd arrested, and you were thinking of sending him to me if he survived. I hung up the phone, got down on my knees, and prayed, please, God, kill that guy. I was on my knees, I mean, on my knees.
He died, said Hooper. Joe was the resident, and she wanted to keep pumping his chest, but I said, as far as I'm concerned, this guy was dead 10 minutes ago. And I left.
Hooper, you're a great man, said EMD. I feel like kissing you.
Kiss me you can. Kiss me if you'd like. But all I know is that if a human disaster like that had shown up in Sausalito, he'd have had to sign his own post-mortem permission slip to be admitted at all.
I think that's a bit crass, said Howie, grinning.
Stay out of Sausalito when you're having your cardiac arrest.
Potts came in, late, made a thin sandwich, and sat down. and I was reminded that the yellow man had yet to die. Potts was haunted by him, linked with him. And whenever we saw Potts, we saw the yellow man. Potts was becoming more withdrawn,